Hey Scope Podcast listeners, Lindsay here. We just wanted to say thanks for listening to our shows. We hope you're nerding out as much as we are. Before we get to today's interview, I wanted to let you know that this episode is sponsored in part by Audible.com. And if you listen to other podcasts, well, you know what that means. Go to audibletrial.com/scopepodcast and you can sign up for a 30-day trial and a free audiobook download of your choice. Mumu and I could talk your ear off about which book you should pick, but you already listened to us enough. Try an audiobook instead. audibletrial.com/scopepodcast. And now, on with the show.
Hi, I'm Mumushu.
And I'm Lindsay Claiborne, and you're listening to Beyond the Microscope.
Hi everyone, it's Lindsay and Mumu back for another episode. Today we have Dr. Amy Carlson, who is an assistant professor in chemical engineering at the University of Maryland. Hi Amy, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for inviting me.
Okay, Amy, let's start off with the very basic question of what is it that you do?
So that's always a good question. I like to say that I am a protein engineer. So we engineer molecules, proteins and peptides specifically. And our main purpose is so that we can use them to study human disease and then hopefully in the long term that we could actually use them to treat disease. We're a bit away from the treating aspect, but we're hopefully going to learn a lot about the diseases that we're working with our proteins and peptides that we're engineering.
Forgive me if this is obvious. How does one do that?
Yeah, that's actually a really great question. So I'll sneak into my professor mode and what I present to our freshmen in our bioengineering 120 biology for engineers. So we can...
Do I get a credit for
sure, if you want to. If you want to.
Okay, good.
You might have to take a test to do that, but...
Oh, okay,
yeah,
never mind.
Yeah, it's okay.
Continue.
So we actually have... There are two main ways that you can approach engineering proteins and peptides. One is from a rational perspective, so we call it rational design. And for rational design, you take what you know about a protein or peptide structure or function, and then you can introduce changes to the amino acids in the sequence of the protein or peptide, and then evaluate what those changes do to the protein. And sometimes we're looking for changes in function. Sometimes we're looking for changes in what we call fitness, which is kind of the ability of the molecule to function in its environment. So thermal stability, folding, those kinds of things. So that's one way. That's the rational way. That's kind of the really thoughtful way of doing it. And the second way that we engineer them is called directed evolution. And in directed evolution, we're trying to mimic the process of natural selection. So we take the gene that encodes for the protein, and typically it's proteins and not peptides in this case, and we make mutations either randomly or in a concentrated fashion to the gene that encodes for the protein. And then we end up with what we call a massive library of proteins. So this is probably on the small side, on the order of about 1 million different proteins, but it can go up to 1 billion or more different proteins. So then you produce those in a microorganism, usually yeast or E. coli, and then you have to somehow find a way to pick out those proteins that have the properties that you're looking for. And so then we design what we call a screen, which allows us to find those specific properties, whether it's binding to something, whether it's an enzymatic activity, whatever the function of the protein is that we're looking for, or the fitness property. We might be looking for thermal stability. We can also look at that. And so we have to design a way to get that property out, because obviously no sane person, and for sure no graduate student, wants to test 1 million or 1 billion different proteins. So they would never graduate.
How would you even begin to test that many? You couldn't, could you?
No, you couldn't. And we, even in some of the assays that we use, it's, you know, we test in 96 well plates. So it's just plastic. It's like tiny little petri dishes all in one place. So we can test, you know, almost 100 at a time, but that's still huge. And so, you know, to think about testing 1 million that way, I mean, it would be, you know, a graduate student's entire career just testing those proteins. So yeah, it wouldn't happen. So what we do is we come up with a screen that lets us look at a huge number really fast. So one way that we do this in my lab is we make our proteins so that they display on the surface of E. coli cells. And so then we can, each E. coli cell produces a different protein in our library. And we're looking at binding, so we can have, we can kind of treat our E. coli cells like a little bead that has the protein on the surface. And then we can actually put our protein that we want, our protein that we're engineering to bind to, on a bead. And then we can basically look for our E. coli cells that will bind to our beads, and then pull those out with a magnet, actually, because we use magnetic beads, and then characterize them further. So, but it's really hard, actually. In directed evolution, it's the thought process doesn't really come in you know, thinking about making the mutations in most cases. It actually comes in developing the screen that lets you look at so many different proteins really quickly. And it's, you know, that's really what protein engineers spend their time thinking about, is how to screen, at least if they're on the directed evolution side.
That's really interesting. So in terms of you're actually looking at the screens and not the sort of directed part of the directed evolution.
Yes.
How do you, are you just banking on the fact that there will be some mutations of which you're interested in?
Yes. So this is actually a really interesting point, because almost all of the mutations that you make are bad. They're not going to give you anything that you can use. So most of the mutations actually produce proteins that are either toxic to the E. coli cells that you're trying to produce them in, or the proteins just are so dysfunctional, they don't fold properly, that you can never even see them. So yeah, we spend just a lot of time on that screen because we want to eliminate all of those things that don't do what we want, and then, you know, have a way that we can distinguish those from the very few that actually have what you want. So it's, you know, depending on what you're doing, you may only pull out, you know, 5 to 10 things that you actually look at moving forward from that, you know, million different proteins. So that's actually an example of one thing that I did. We had a million different members of our protein library, and we only looked at about 10 of those to further characterize them, and we may have missed some good ones because we did only look at that many. But the, you know, there's, that's why in general you want a huge library size, is because if you have a bigger library, your library is more likely to contain proteins that have those mutations that will give you what you're looking for. But ultimately, your library only needs to be big enough to hold what you want. The problem is you can't predict that ahead of time necessarily.
Sorry, this may sound like a stupid question, but so what's the point of doing all this? What do you get out of that?
So what we get, you know, I'll just give you an example from my lab. So one thing that we're trying to engineer is synthetic antibodies. So these are small antibodies that bind to a target that's important in health. So we're looking at one protein that's involved in cancer. So one area we work in is in cancer. It's a protein called survivin, and that protein helps cancer cells survive and not die like they're supposed to. And that's one hallmark of cancer, is that the cells just keep growing and dividing and they don't die. And so we can, our idea is that if we can make an antibody that will bind to this protein, it can block the function by, you know, basically, you know, tying up that protein so it can't do what it's supposed to do. So we're making antibodies that do that, but the challenge is that, you know, survivin is a protein that functions inside of cells. And the antibodies that we have in our body were evolved by nature to function outside of cells. So they have disulfide bonds, which don't form inside of cells because inside of cells have reducing environment. And to, I guess, put that in more layman's terms, basically our proteins can't have the shape that they need to bind to their target when they're inside of cells without doing some special engineering. So that's one thing we're doing, is we're engineering those antibodies so they can fold and function without those structural components that they normally require to fold and function. So, and that's one thing that we're doing. And, you know, people, you know, also will engineer proteins for enzymes. So there's a huge part of protein engineering right now that's working on engineering enzymes that will help degrade biomass so that you can think about getting to biofuels. So basically any kind of place that a protein might work in therapeutics or in industry, people are interested in engineering the proteins to be better so that they'll work faster, they'll work at higher temperatures, they'll be less likely to degrade due to whatever else is around. So, you know, we basically want to try to take whatever nature has and see if we can make it better, which doesn't always work.
So this would go into like a medication or something that was being designed by, like, as a drug,
yes,
right? Is that what you're saying?
So that's,
okay. So you're maybe.
Yeah. So in some cases, you know, that's what we're interested in, the medical applications. So we're really looking at trying to design these proteins or peptides that you know, may have some therapeutic benefit. You know, right now we're pretty far away from that. I like to think.
Right. So you're like designing the things that could fix things later, which then might get turned into a therapeutic that might then go help fight this form of cancer or whatever. Okay, yeah. I gotcha. So we're way at the beginning stages of manipulating proteins in a way that could help us for other things.
Yeah, and the other thing is that just that, you know, in some cases when we're engineering these proteins, we're engineering them to interact with things inside the cell. So then we can also think about them as basic tools for studying the biology. So, you know, ultimately they may lead to treatments, but, you know, in the early stages, even if they don't lead to treatments, they can still help us understand how things function in the cell and what's interacting with what, and trying to control some of these interactions to figure out more about how cells work and how disease happens, basically, and how it is maintained in the human body.
How long does this entire process or take?
Way longer than anybody wants it to. So when we're talking about directed evolution, you know, we're working on new techniques for directed evolution, so it takes us longer because it's not, you know, we have to spend time making sure our techniques work and they're giving us what we want. So so it will take, you know, months even to get one protein that we might want to look at this stage. But there are techniques out there already that people are using that are more standard. So yeast display, for example, and phage display, which are just different types of surface display that don't have that property of looking at intracellular proteins. These methods are pretty well established. And so, you know, people can just in a few weeks probably have some things to start looking at. But it takes a long time to really do all the tests on it to make sure that you have exactly what you're looking for. There's a saying in directed evolution that comes from Francis Arnold at Caltech that says, you get what you screen for. So one of the things that we have to think about is if you don't design your screen really carefully, you might actually be evolving your proteins for a property that's not quite what you're looking for. So one example is when you're evolving an enzyme that's going to perform some reaction or catalyze some reaction in a cell, you often might start with a synthetic substrate that when that enzyme acts on that substrate, it releases a color or it releases fluorescence so that you can see that it's happening. And that lets you more easily look through a lot of different proteins. But, you know, that's a synthetic substrate. It's not the real substrate you want to work on. So sometimes when you take those enzymes you've engineered and go back to that real substrate, it doesn't actually work on the real substrate. So you have to just be really careful to really clearly define what you want it to do and design your screen to get exactly at what you want to get at.
Is this exciting stuff? I it sounds like interesting, especially if you find the right thing, but I'm curious, it's like, because it's a long process and it's pretty tedious, do you feel like you get an end result that works, or are you like, oh, this is so, like the end goal is so far away?
I have a story for my postdoc where we were getting really frustrated because we kept pulling out things that weren't working like we wanted. But then I did finally get the result and it was really exciting. So I actually taped it up on the refrigerator in the lab. And and then I took another copy home and I taped it up on my refrigerator at home so that I could look at it every day and see that, yes, it does work. It takes a lot of time. But when you get it, it's really exciting because if you're coming up with new methods, then you're potentially coming up with ways that you can use to engineer proteins in new ways. Or if you're using, you know, the more traditional methods that people have been using for a while, then you actually have something that might work and might do something good to study disease. So it's really funny. So the directed evolution side is a lot slower in some ways than the rational engineering side or rational design side. Because in rational design, you just make the changes and you test them. But of course, in rational design, you're only making a few changes at a time because you have to make each protein or peptide that has that change. And that can be a long and expensive process depending on how you do it. So you only test a few. The nice thing about directed evolution is you can test a million different proteins at one time. It's just sometimes it takes a lot of steps to be able to design your methods to get exactly what you want.
So you had mentioned that you use E. coli as these sort of beads,
yes.
Right? Why E. coli?
So that's actually a really good question. So E. coli have a pathway in them. So all cells basically have ways that they get proteins that they make inside the cells to the outside of cells. So E. coli do that in a few different ways, and they have a special method of doing it that's called the twin arginine translocation pathway. Doesn't really matter exactly what that means for people that know a little bit about proteins. There are two arginines in the sequence that are conserved, and so that's where it gets the twin arginine name. But we call it the TAT pathway for short, just because then we don't have to say that long name all the time. And yeah, and protein engineers actually really like acronyms. But so in our case, we're using E. coli because they have this twin arginine translocation pathway. And this pathway, it only transports proteins out of the cell that are well folded in the cell. And this is in contrast to how a lot of other methods work for getting proteins out of the cell. And in those cases, they actually transport the proteins and they fold after translocation. So we can use this TAT pathway to help us engineer antibodies that fold inside of cells, because we have this, basically the E. coli have this screening method built in, where if we tell the E. coli to make our proteins and send them out through this TAT pathway, they're only going to get put on the surface of the E. coli cells if they are folded inside the cells. So we basically are getting the bacteria to do the work for us, which is always nice because bacteria grow really fast and really cheaply. So so that's why we use E. coli. You know, a lot of people use yeast for engineering proteins and also phage. And the challenge with using those methods is they rely on a different translocation system. They use the method that folds proteins after they're translocated. So once the proteins are outside of the inner membrane of E. coli or outside of the ER of the yeast cells, that's when they fold. So there's no folding quality control for the inside of cells in that environment where their disulfide bonds can't form.
How did somebody figure out that E. coli was the way to do this?
So this is really...
Or is this common? It's been going on for years.
No, you know, it isn't. And, you know, it was my postdoc advisor, Matt DeLisa, really worked on a lot of this when he was a postdoc in George Arju's lab at the University of Texas. And it really came from looking at this translocation pathway and really seeing how bacteria were moving their proteins around. And plants also have this system, and it's actually been studied much better in plants. And so once people were starting to understand it in plants, it made it easier to try to learn a little bit more about it in E. coli. So it's and right now there are very few groups that actually use it, because it is something that I worked on in the DeLisa lab, and so his lab still works on it a little bit, and we're working on it, and some other people that worked with us are doing it, but it's not a particularly common method yet. And of course, our goal is that we make it so good that everybody wants to use it. So that's why we're spending some time trying to figure out the details on how to make it work right.
Amy, how did you get interested in this particular area?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. When I started as an undergraduate, I actually thought I wanted to go to medical school. And I just chose to go into chemical engineering because one of my high school teachers was like, oh, you're good at math and science, you should be an engineer. And I said, okay, why not? And I had no idea.
Whatever.
Yeah, I had no idea what chemical engineers did at the time. And if I knew what they did, I never would have decided to major in it, because I had no desire to work in a plant and design processes like that. But the chemical engineering really works a lot at the molecular level and trying to understand molecular processes. So it actually turned out that to be a really good background for thinking about biology. So as an undergraduate, I did research in a lot of different areas. I shouldn't say a lot, but I did more. I had about 3 or 4 research experiences before I finally figured out what I liked. And that was, you know, applying some of this molecular engineering to studying biological problems. And, you know, as a graduate student, in chemical engineering, it's a little different than some other fields. In chemical engineering, you typically get admitted to a graduate program. And once you get there, you talk to professors and see what projects they have. And somehow I was just really interested in the projects that were really highly focused on biology. And I'm sure it came from, you know, having that interest initially to to go into medicine. And right. So I worked on a peptide engineering project as a graduate student, where we were engineering peptides that would kill a fungal pathogen. And it's probably really appropriate for a podcast that focuses on women, but the fungal pathogen that we were trying to kill was the one that causes yeast infections. So,
oh, can we please kill that?
Yeah.
That
would be lovely. Yes. My mom was so thrilled when I told her I was killing fungus and I was killing yeast. And she said, "Are you going to cure yeast infections?" And I was like, "That's my goal." So yeah.
Yes. Yes. You've just gotten a whole bunch more backers.
No, I know. Right? And actually we're still, so we do the cancer work is one aspect of what we do. And we also mm-hmm. still have a lot of my lab still works with that pathogen. It's called Candida albicans. But we're working on ways that we can kill the pathogen with little peptides, and also ways that we might be able to deliver molecules into the cells that ultimately might kill them. So we're, yeah. So I love yeast. It's probably not something that most people want to hear, but
yeast has many purposes.
Yeah, it does. And
we eat it all the time.
We do.
I am brewing beer with it right now. I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah. Actually, what's interesting is the pathogen that causes yeast infections is actually very closely related to the pathogen, to the yeast that you use in bread or in beer. So it has a lot of similar properties, but it also has some really unique biology. And I think that's one of the reasons I like to study it, is because it's, in addition to being something that causes disease, it has some biology that kind of makes it unique. It grows in both a yeast form and in what we call a filamentous form. It kind of makes like long strings that you think of more like when you think of a mold and not a yeast. But yeah, it's really interesting, and it causes disease all over your body. So it, you know, vaginal yeast infections are the ones most people think about. And but it also causes oral yeast infections. So the AIDS patients often get what's called oral thrush. So it's a yeast infection in the mouth. Babies will sometimes get it as well because their immune systems aren't fully developed. It can cause diaper rash. So it's a pathogen that you run into all the time, but it's not one you really want to run into.
So are you the one at cocktail parties that you start bringing up these topics? So we've had a previous guest who goes down the rabbit hole when it comes to the herpes
right,
virus.
Oh, that's our cocktail party story.
Yeah, I completely do that. I would start talking about, people ask me what I do. And one of the projects I like to talk about is our project with this fungus, because most of us have it in our mouth. So, you know, it's weird to think that you have it in your mouth and in your vagina, but but it's true. So
you're like, and yeah, continue to share that drink that
yes,
you just passed
yes,
over
exactly,
to your partner over there.
Exactly. And so there's one of the things we're doing is we're working with a peptide that's found in our saliva. And for most people, this peptide helps keep the fungus from causing an infection in your mouth. It just keeps the levels in check so that they can't overgrow and make a mess and cause thrush. So, but people who have AIDS, for example, often don't produce as much of this peptide. And also people who don't produce a lot of saliva also don't have the peptide because it's found in the saliva. So one thing we're doing is we're, you know, studying this peptide and trying to make it a better antifungal agent. And what's interesting is we have this peptide that helps kill the fungus, but the fungus actually secretes enzymes that can degrade the peptide. So it's kind of like, you know, we have this defense and the fungus has this counter defense to our defense. And so we're trying to make the peptide so that it won't get degraded by these enzymes that the fungus makes. So we're trying to make it really sturdy and just make modifications so that the enzyme can't cut it up, so it can stay intact and kill our friend, the fungus that's hanging out in our mouth. So it's kind of a fun project. But when you start talking about that at a party, you have to be careful who you talk to. So I'm not grossed out by anything, but
I warned Mumu before this conversation. I was like, Mumu, I hope you've already eaten.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Moved all the food away.
Well, I actually have a little side story that you might find interesting. When I was a graduate student, I was watching a lecture by a relatively famous mycologist, so somebody who works with fungi. And so he was talking about the idea of an opportunistic pathogen. So the fungus I work with is often called an opportunistic pathogen because it's around in our body normally. It doesn't cause any problems, but it can, if it finds a weakness in your immune system, it can cause disease. So he was actually mentioning Saccharomyces cerevisiae, baker's yeast and brewer's yeast, and talking about the fact that it can actually cause disease as well. So you may not know this, but Saccharomyces cerevisiae can actually cause vaginal yeast infection. And there was a study that was done where they actually cultured yeast from a woman's yeast infection and from her husband's pizza dough at his pizza shop and from his hands. So it's a kind of interesting.
It's everywhere.
It's everywhere. And she had his pizza yeast in her yeast infection. So not sure how much your listeners would really like to hear that, but it's a story that I enjoy.
But that's sort of the stuff that's fascinating, right? Those are things you never think that – you don't think those kinds of things are that closely related.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I had to go – after I saw this lecture, I went back to my office and I pulled up the paper because I just thought it was so crazy. And it's published in the scientific literature, this whole thing about culturing the yeast from different places. So yeah. I mean, his whole point was that this idea of an opportunistic infection is a little contrived because a lot of organisms, given the right conditions, will grow more than they're supposed to and cause problems, but in most cases there isn't an issue. So, but yeah, that's a fun of my fun little
that's
story
good.
on Saccharomyces and pizza and yeast infections.
Properly washing one's hands.
Yes. This is completely in our lab. We have a rule in my lab: you don't leave the lab unless you wash your hands. And frankly, yeah. I think that the females are much more likely to follow that process because they
they know what they're in for.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not something you want to.
I feel like that should be common practice in every lab. Frankly,
it should be. But the way that I get my students to do it is I tell them, this can cause yeast infections, and realistically, it can cause yeast infections in a vagina or on a penis. So that's new information. So
that covers everyone.
And they all look at, they look at you horrified and go, I'm going to go wash my hands now. Thanks.
Yes. Yeah, we were actually having this conversation in my research meeting a couple weeks ago and talking about vaginas and penises and yeast. And then somebody walked in a little bit late and was walking in just as we were discussing yeast infections on the penis, and they were a little confused. It was a poor undergraduate, so I felt a little bit bad.
Oh, no. I'm just imagining having a similar type discussion with my advice. I could never. I just am mortified just thinking about that.
You would start laughing.
I know.
In the
I'm already
and turn
right
red
now.
And then walk out of the room.
Well, I think my students would, but I brought it up. I think is probably why, because when you work with a pathogen that causes disease in these places, you have to just start to be comfortable saying the words. Because otherwise you get up in a talk and you're like, oh yeah, vagina, vagina. And that's vaginal yeast infections are what people most recognize with the pathogen we work with. And females tend to be pretty comfortable talking about it, but males are not. Mm-hmm. The minute I say it in a presentation, I just watch the men in the room squirm just a little bit. So it's sort of fun. It's sort of fun just to say it, just to watch them squirm.
Well, but you're absolutely right, though. We're too afraid to talk about a lot of these things for whatever reason. And that is exactly what you're studying. There's a reason you're studying it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can't be like hedge while you're studying something.
Well, and
because somebody might get uncomfortable.
And it makes it more relevant. I mean, if you tell people that you're working on a fungal pathogen that causes disease in people who have AIDS, most people are like, okay, whatever. I don't have AIDS. I don't have to worry about it. Or, it'll cause disease in cancer patients who are undergoing chemotherapy as well. And they're like, oh, I'm healthy. I don't have to worry about it. But when you tell them you're working with something that causes yeast infections, all of a sudden, you're like, okay, yeah. Because these are old statistics, but from when I was in graduate school. But at that time, I think 75% of women would get a yeast infection at some point in their life. And 50% of them would have one by the time they were age 25. So it's something that it really affects a lot of people. And some people will get them and they're recurrent. So it's a challenge. But yeah, so I like to remind people that we should just say these words and not be embarrassed by them.
Absolutely.
And it's an added bonus if people start squirming.
Oh, yeah. It's It's fun to watch.
Looking sort of 5 years, 10 years down the future, what gets you most excited about this?
I think for me, the most exciting thing is the idea that we could be making molecules that could actually find their way into treatments, or could find their way into the process of developing treatments. So what keeps me motivated on a daily basis is the fact that what we're doing ultimately may help people. And this goes back to my interest in medicine and really wanting to do something that has an impact beyond just studying the basic science. I love basic science, don't get me wrong, but the idea that we're learning things that we could actually apply to making people's lives better is really exciting to me. And so that's what I love. I really do want to come up with new treatments and new cures for yeast infections. So as odd as that sounds, that is something I think that would help a lot of people.
Go like sort of looking ahead, I mean, talking about new technology, like, is there something on the horizon that's like a big marker? I mean, you know, we're talking about, you know, you're hoping to cure yeast infections or come up with a solution for yeast infections. Is there sort of like a reach point? This question may not make any sense, but if there's a reach point of like, we aim to be able to do this in 10 years, or the next big thing this process could do is cure cancer.
Yeah.
I'm making things up.
No, it's actually really interesting that you asked that question, because I think it is that way. I think we have, you know, protein engineers around the world are really working to cure pretty much any disease you can think about. So people are, you know, we're working on cancer a little bit. There are people working on cancer in other ways than we are. So we're targeting this one protein. People are looking at being able to target cancer cells to come up with really specific treatments. So, you know, cancer is one place that people are looking at. Another area that's really big in protein engineering and antibody engineering specifically is looking at neurodegenerative diseases. So Alzheimer's, Parkinson's disease, where these diseases are caused by proteins that misbehave. So the proteins fold in ways that they're not supposed to. They aggregate and they cause these problems in the neural system. So people are looking at ways that we can use proteins and antibodies to disrupt the formation of these, or maybe even to reverse the formation. And there's a lot of work going on doing this and showing that you can engineer really cool molecules that will disrupt these formations. So Pete Tessier's lab at Rensselaer Polytech has these antibody-like molecules where they actually insert part of the molecule that aggregates in Alzheimer's disease, and they use that to disrupt the aggregation. So basically, their protein can bind where the protein would normally aggregate, and it stops the protein from aggregating. And they've also found, and I don't think that they've looked at the mechanism yet, but they've also found that they can actually disrupt aggregates that are already formed. So I think, you know, really, I think cancer is always the big one, just because, you know, our country puts a lot of money into cancer research, but neurodegenerative diseases are also big. I'm one of the few people that is working in fungal disease, and there are very few protein engineers that care about fungal disease, but I think that's why it's important. You know, we have an antibiotic shortage right now, and bacterial disease is a major issue. Because of that, it's hard to find antibiotics that will treat some of these drug-resistant infections. And we're working our way towards that with fungal disease too. So my goal with our fungal work is really to, you know, come up with new therapeutics before fungal disease gets to the point where we don't have effective drugs anymore, kind of trying to, you know, avoid this problem we're having with our bacterial infections.
Amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that made me think of something with the antibacterial, like antibiotics, and we're becoming sort of more antibiotic resistant. Is what you're working on a way to get around some of these resistance issues we have?
It is in fungal pathogens. So we're
right, obviously,
yes,
in fungus instead.
You know, I don't know as much about the bacteria and those, but in fungal disease, you know, not just the pathogen we work with, but also with a lot of other fungal pathogens, people target only a few different targets. So there are some key differences between fungal cells and human cells, though actually fungal cells are more similar to our cells than they are to bacteria, which is maybe kind of scary in some ways. But they, you know, there are a few key differences. One is the cell wall. So yeast cells and other fungal cells have a cell wall that surrounds the cell membrane. So a lot of our drugs focus on that cell wall as a target. So they either look at, you know, disrupting enzymes that help make that cell wall, or proteins that are in the cell wall. So that's that's one way that we can target fungal cells specifically. Fungal cells also have in their membranes a molecule called ergosterol, which is an analog to cholesterol. So that's another target. So the synthesis of ergosterol and ergosterol itself are also targets. But those are really the main targets that are used in treating fungal disease. And so as fungi start to get resistant to those, we really have to think about, you know, how can we identify new targets, and how can we make molecules that the pathogens can't as easily adapt to? So it's one of the things that we think about in what we're doing, because it doesn't do us any good if we make a new molecule and then, you know, 5 years down the road, the organisms are resistant again, because then we're right back where we started and we have to design new treatments again.
This was amazing, Amy. Thank you so much for being on our show. We learned quite a bit.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Like our show? Find out more at scopepodcast.com and follow us online on Facebook and Twitter at Scope Podcast. This is Lindsay Claiborne
and Mumu Shu.
Our theme music was composed by The Copycuts. Thanks for listening.